This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up with social media, texting, and video chats, is there still room for a good old-fashioned postcard? Our guest says definitely. We'll look at the history of the postcard and all the different industries that are involved in making them happen. Now, earlier this week, victims of sexual abuse by former team doctor Larry Nassar reached a $380 million settlement with USA Gymnastics and the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee. Here's former gymnast Rachel Den Hollander, who was the first victim to come forward publicly with allegations against Nassar, talking to the BBC.
I think it's important to recognize what it really took to get here. It took over 500 women. It took 5 years. It took dozens of survivors willing to go through the court process in Michigan and become victims whose crimes were charged. It took so much incredible effort and sacrifice of so many people. And I think one of the lessons that we have to learn is, A, what it takes to get here, but also start asking the question, how do we create a system of justice where it doesn't require Olympians and over 500 survivors to come forward to reach this? Because what happens to the survivors who don't have anyone? If it was this uphill of a battle for Nassar survivors and USAG survivors, what does it look like for sexual abuse survivors who don't have anyone? And how do we start creating justice for that?
We've talked about the charges against Nassar in the past on the show. Now we're looking to the future and how to create sports programs with a system of safety, accountability, and transparency so we hopefully don't end up here again. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction been to the settlement with victims of Larry Nassar? Do you have questions about how sports organizations are set up currently to deal with allegations of misconduct or assault? If you work in an athletic program at any level, youth through college or pro, what do you like, what do you not like about how your organization handles these concerns? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. B. David Ridpath is Associate Professor of Sports Business at Ohio University. He's an expert in a variety of related issues, including sports governance, NCAA rules and compliance, and risk management. He's author of the book Alternative Models of Sports Development in America, Solutions to a Crisis in Education and Public Health. Dave, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Appreciate being on. Thanks so much.
So we had this settlement. There's the dollar amount, but another part of the settlement wasn't monetary. It's a requirement that at least one abuse survivor have a seat on the board of directors for USA Gymnastics. What's your reaction to that part of it, bringing in somebody who's been through all of this into the management of the organization?
Well, I think one of the biggest things we can do in sports governance to help, better protect the athletes, but I also think to run sports organizations better, that it is important to have representation on all committees at all levels of governance in all sports organizations, have representation of the athletes. And this goes back, Rob, to the Amateur Sports Act in the 70s, of where when the USOC was created, one of the main emphasis of that overhaul of amateur sports in America was that the committees of the USOC would have at least 20% athlete representation. Now, I'm not here to say that it's perfect, but it is very important that, essentially like anything else, you can go to labor unions, you can go to any type of governance in any other aspect. It is important to have, whether you could call it workers, athlete, labor, whatever you want, it is important to have their representation and their voice within the governance structure. That better protects the athlete.
Now, it seems like we've seen this kind of story again and again. Women's gymnastics, the biggest example. We've seen, high-profile football programs, Penn State and others. Women's pro soccer. Just again and again, sport after sport, some kind of abuse or harassment, and then a lack of response from the organization when those things are brought up internally. What do you think needs to change so that instead of waiting years and years, at the first sign, the first hint of a problem, better action is taken?
Well, I do agree. I mean, I think, we have this issue in sports that has permeated, literally almost since its inception, that we want to protect what is important to us. We want to protect, what we love. We want to protect the competitive aspect, the branding of it, whatever you want to talk about it. And oftentimes the bad news conflicts with what we really want to put forth in the public. And so I do think that you have leaders, not at all times, but many times in the situation, certainly in the Nassar situation, that were more concerned with protecting themselves and protecting the brand rather than getting to the bottom of what was happening. And that's where, again, it comes to obviously leadership, good moral and ethical leadership of people who are willing to do the right thing and who have the backbone to do the right thing, even in the face of extreme pressure. You know, my background is college athletics. People do not want to hear about bad things in their college athletics program. They only want to win. They want to be entertained. And certainly with the case of USA Gymnastics, you know, they want to protect that persona. But if you have athletes in the governance structure, they are more likely to go out and protect their own. They're more likely to come out and say, look, you have a place to go to. You have representation. You have somebody who's going to stand up for you. And really, in the old governance structure, that wasn't there. There was no place for an Allie Raceman to go when, you know, Bella Caroli had total power, or somebody like Larry Nassar was protected by the gymnastics coach or the athletic director. You give the athletes the access and the voice and the ability to have input on their day-to-day lives and what affects them, certainly athletically and personally, I do believe that this can change.
You mentioned protecting what we value in an athletic organization, and that maybe that's a fundamental thing we need to rethink. Is the thing we value the winning record in the bowl game appearances or the gold medals at the Olympics and other world competitions, or is the valuable thing resource we ought to protect the athletes themselves?
Well, you'd like to think that we would want to protect the athletes themselves and do the right thing. I've often said, and this is kind of a simple way of looking at it, but sports makes rational people irrational. Look, I'm a fan. I have my favorite teams. I love to see my team win. But working in the industry, I don't think that there's a more bottom line industry in the world. You either win or you don't. And if you don't win, it's usually problematic in some way. You could even look at Urban Meyer today. If Urban Meyer was 13-2 and not 2-13, he wouldn't have been fired today, regardless of all the situations surrounding him. And that's sad when you think about this. What I tell my classes, Rob, is this, is that you can't do something in sports or not do something in sports that you would do in your normal walk of life. So the standard you walk by is the standard you accept. But because winning is the bottom line, and you're not successful if you don't win, and you're going to try to do everything, and I'm saying this more generally, but people often are going to try to get the edge, sadly, by any means necessary. Oftentimes it is the athlete that is the exploited one, while many others get the glory and get rich.
Talking to Dave Ridpath from Ohio University in Athens, associate professor there of sports business, looking at issues of how we set up athletic organizations, especially amateur ones, college, Olympic, World Cup, especially after the settlement now in the gymnastics abuse case. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been part of an organization like this, a college athletics program, say? What worked? What didn't? Were there things you needed to see changed? Are our priorities wrong? Do we focus too much on the record, the gold medals, the outcomes, not enough on the development of the athletes? 800-642-1234 and their well-being. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dave, you've mentioned the idea a couple times of, you know, athletics being represented in the management of their organization. Can you point toward an organization or two that you think is doing it right, that is implementing this and it's making a difference?
Well, I do think it maybe some people would disagree. And you know, look, I'm a child of the 60s and 70s, and I certainly liked it when you could say in professional sports that you'd have the same team for 10 or 12 years. But certainly having the labor movement in professional sports and having the players unions has better protected the players, right? They've been able to stand up against, you know, against bullying owners and other things like that. So you have to point to that as an example of the athletes have a voice, and things cannot be decided without the athletes having an equal place at the table. And that's really where, you know, in the Olympics, going back to the Amateur Sports Act, in the overall governance structure, we certainly have athlete representation within the USOC, but certainly the individual athlete was not as empowered within the national governing bodies and the individual sports as they should be. And at least having that place that they know they can go to, that, you know, hey, this is a problem. Even if somebody says this is a legitimate medical procedure, I need to talk to somebody about this and to have that type of outlet. And so at least, you know, you have player representation in professional sports. And I do believe a model like that is a similar one that could work in other sports governance situations.
A college athletes union of sorts?
Absolutely. And I've long advocated that you can have a college athletes union, a non-wage based, if you will, college athletes union that could actually be representative of all college athletes and negotiate everything other than a wage and benefits, because the pay to play issue, although I certainly believe that college athletes are employees and they certainly have a legitimate claim to being paid as employees because we treat them as employees, but we say they're students, and you can't say they're students and treat as employees. You can't have it both ways. But you can certainly have a non-wage type union that can negotiate everything else. Healthcare, even with name, image, and likeness and all the things we've heard the past couple of days, what I've told my friends in the NCAA structure is you need to negotiate directly with the athletes. If you don't want them to do pornography or alcohol advertisements, you collectively negotiate that with them so it's agreed upon by all parties. Don't try to mandate that to them, or even have an outside entity like the government or different states regulate that. If you have a bargaining agreement, and again, it doesn't have to be pay to play. If you have a bargaining agreement like that, you really give the athletes a voice and they have input on this decision-making. And right now in college sports, the athletes have absolutely zero input on the decisions that are made for them.
We're talking to Dave Ridpath, Associate Professor of Sports Business at Ohio University. Talk about ways that sports organizations could reform to stamp out, prevent assaults and cover-ups like we've seen come to light from USA Gymnastics and many other organizations in the sports world. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. With large sports organizations, who do you want to see held accountable for abuse on their watch? Are there reforms you'd like to see at, say, major university sports programs, national teams, Olympic and Paralympic committee? Would you like to rebuild them from the ground up? Do you have experience in these kinds of organizations yourself? What do you think? Call 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea of a college athletes union, not for wages, but to talk about everything else? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now we're picking up our talk about reforming or reimagining sports organizations to be safer, more accountable, and to better protect athletes, especially, say, student athletes or young athletes in national programs. Dave Ridpath is Associate Professor of Sports Business at Ohio University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like big name coaches have too much power in athletic organizations? Are there changes you'd like to see maybe in an organization you've been part of? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Dave, some sports leaders, I'm thinking mainly college football coaches, some gymnastics coaches, others, there's almost like a cult status around them. Do you think that the balance of power swings sometimes too strongly to those rock star figures in the sports world?
Well, it really does. And speaking in, you know, certainly my world of college sports, you know, to me, it's completely backward that that a coach is the highest paid employee in, I think, 43 or 44 of the states, whether it's a college basketball coach or a college football coach. That really is a problem with our society of what we value. And a lot of people will come out and say that, you know, that, well, that's the market value of the coaches. Well, it's really not. When you don't pay the labor, that is an artificial market that has been essentially inflated in our win at all cost culture. You have to win or you don't. And I think we crossed the $100 million barrier a couple of weeks ago of coaches that are being paid not to coach. This is in a higher education environment. This is absolutely ridiculous. And that's why a group that I'm a part of, the Drake Group, named after Drake University, where we had our first meeting over 20 years ago, is we are petitioning Congress for a very limited antitrust exemption to control out-of-control costs in intercollegiate athletics, because there is so much of it that is simply not needed. It's a race to the top. It's an arms race, essentially, and specifically with salaries. There's a power dynamic there. If you have a president that's only making $1 million and you have a football coach who's one is winning, he or she is winning, and is making $5 million, who's going to have the de facto power on that campus? And we certainly saw that with Joe Paterno. We've seen that at Michigan State. And so in my view, that just even the pay structure and having a limited antitrust exemption and essentially say that coaches cannot get paid more, $1, have to be paid $1 less than the highest paid person on that campus. And you take Wisconsin-Madison, there's some pretty highly paid people on that campus, whether it's the president, might be a research scholar who brought in some grant money. Those coaches are still going to get paid quite handsomely. We do not need to be paying college coaches $10 million a year, because that sets the whole leadership and governance structure on its head. And it puts those coaches in many positions where they can get away with anything, especially if they're winning. And that needs to change.
I know you have concerns, I think, about just how closely interwoven amateur athletics and colleges are. Is it time to divorce education from sports?
I wouldn't say so much of a divorce, Rob, as maybe a reimagining. It is important for your listeners to know, if they don't know this, but we are the only country in the world that has a significant portion of all athletic development, whether at the elite or mass participation level, grounded in the education system. Now, on paper, it sounds very good. Hey, you play a sport, you're going to school, and certainly from a college perspective, hey, college is expensive. Here's a way that you can offset some costs by playing a sport. It's very counterintuitive, as a matter of fact, and sometimes being the only country in the world that does something maybe isn't the smartest thing to do. We need in America, and this is what I talk about in my book that I know you're going to mention, my book Alternative Models, is we need other options of elite sport development outside the education space. Because it is our primary development system, not only for our international and national teams, and the fact that educationally based sports, specifically college athletics, is so commercially driven, it has made our whole system throughout more of a race to the top. And school-based sports are supposed to be about sound mind and body and participation and exposure to sports. We need to have, like Europe does, models outside the education system where those elite athletes who are elite, and they should, and we should as a country provide those options to train, get an education, and go as far as they can in their sport, but do that outside the education system. Because we're putting so much emphasis on football and basketball, we're losing sports in the system we have right now. And also, we are losing the ability for kids to be able to participate at all levels because we're focusing on winning, as most of your listeners know, even at the lowest youth sports levels, that it does have a very huge public health impact. And I know that's kind of a large mouthful, what I said there, but it isn't eliminating and divorcing completely, but we do need to reimagine the elite sport and commercialized sport connection to our education system.
Let's bring on a caller now. Mike is with us in Oconomowoc. Mike, hi.
Hi. I'm just curious, because when I hear these conversations about this, given that sports has got to be the number one draw of money to any campus, and I just moved here from North Carolina not too long ago, on Duke and UNC Chapel Hill. I mean, if they didn't have basketball, say, as draw, would they even get the amount of grants and research grants and student population or draw for the highest level of students into those schools without that kind of background and backbone of a great sports, arena for them?
I gotcha, Mike. We don't have too much time left. But his point, Dave, these sports programs can be big advertisements to bring in students, research money, and more.
It's a fair question. I will tell you, we're talking about research, has not really shown that these universities having a major sports program has led to, research grants. In fact, some of our, I would say, poor, not poor, maybe less successful programs. Their schools have massive research grants. The attachment to attendance and marketing and those types of things, again, is very nebulous. I always say this, you know, Duke and North Carolina or Wisconsin-Madison, they would exist without the football program and they would, or athletic program, and they would be just fine. I mean, we look at some of these research grants that are brought in, they're in the billions of dollars and it eclipses what athletics bring in. I do think it is, there's a lot of myth that to be a great university, you have to have a great athletic program or even have an athletic program. My point is, Rob, is that you can still have intercollegiate athletics. If Duke and North Carolina, it almost doesn't matter who plays, people are going to show up to watch. What I'm saying is that the elite athlete and the main pathway to the NBA, the NFL, and to our national teams should not be only through the educational system. And right now, that is the pathway about 85% of the time. And that's what we need to change. Sports can still exist on campus, but it doesn't need to exist at the level it is. And North Carolina and Duke, you know, North Carolina was a university before they ever had a football and basketball team. They will exist just fine.
Very briefly, just in our last few moments, Dave, do you see sports organizations, especially in college, rethinking their systems to improve them?
You know, I hope so. I do think that a lot of this is going to be driven. I think, you know, ultimately we might see, not that the NCAA wants to do it, but we might see college athletes being paid. And I do think that many schools might have to reimagine what they're doing. And I think that's okay. Maybe only some schools can actually afford to pay college athletes a salary or continue on the path they're going on now. And that's okay. And maybe the other schools go to more of an academic model. But I also believe as changes are going on that other systems are going to manifest themselves. And we need to, as a country, address, you know, more access at all levels, mass participation and recreation to help our public health aspect. According to Johns Hopkins, if we simply had kids right now between under the age of 18, active another 90 minutes per week, that we would save over 30 years, close to $1 trillion in medical costs. I mean,
and we'll leave it there. And I hope to talk to you about that again sometime. Dave Ridpath has been with us, author of the book Alternative Models of Sports Development. He's at Ohio University. Joined us for a look at rethinking the way amateur athletics are organized. You've heard about millipedes, right? Those invertebrate critters with lots of legs. The name millipede literally means thousand legs, but that's a ballpark figure. The maximum leg count for any millipede was like 750. None of them really got close to 1,000. Until now. According to a scientific report in the journal Scientific Reports, researchers in Australia found a millipede that lived 200 feet underground. It's just over 3.5 inches long, and legs, 1,306. How do you count those tiny legs? Very carefully. According to the scientists, they dyed the legs and color-coded them to make sure they didn't double count any of them. Then they counted three times to make sure they had the number right. The new record holder for the most legs of any species on Earth is called Eumillipes Persephone. So are there any minor league sports teams looking for a mascot? I've got a logo for you. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Not all that long ago, when you went on a vacation, you probably sent a postcard to mom, dad, a close friend. Maybe you grabbed one with a photo of the place you were visiting, wrote a quick note on the back. Maybe "Wish You Were Here" was featured on there, slapped on a really cheap stamp. A few days later, it gets delivered. The recipient gets excited with that fun piece of mail, and they get to read the personalized note. Maybe they even saved it and put it in a box. But now that we have smartphones and easy access to email and social media, are postcards still relevant? Our next guest says yes. She's got a new book coming out on the history of postcards, all the different industries that are involved with making them happen, the role they played in the past and present. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you still send postcards? Why or why not? How do you feel when you get them, if you do? Is there a particular postcard you remember sending or receiving? Do you have that treasure trove, a box of your own or someone else's postcards? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Lydia Pine is an affiliate researcher in the Institute for Historical Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. She's the author of Postcards, The Rise and Fall of the World's First Social Network. It hits the shelves next week. Lydia, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
I mentioned that treasure trove, that box of postcards, maybe from a family member. You had one of those, right?
Yes, I started this project with one of those boxes. And since I've been working on this project, have been gifted with several more. Excuse me. It seems that the once family members find out that you're interested in the postcard project, they keep coming. They recirculate, if you will, which is awesome. But yes, my interest in this project really was sparked by having been gifted this box of postcards from the turn of the 20th century, and looking through postcards that my great-grandfather had received, and just sort of starting to think about all of the different ways that postcards function as a social network.
You write that postcards are the largest class of artifacts that humankind has ever exchanged. Can you give us a sense of the scope, especially in the heyday of the postcard?
Yeah, it really shocked me to realize just how many postcards have been made and sent and printed and read and received going around the world. So historians estimate that in the first two decades of the 20th century, so 1900 to 1920, something like 200 billion, so billion with a B, postcards were in global circulation. And when I came across that, that really set me back to just think about the sheer amount of work and labor and ideas and technology that go into all of the parts that are required to send a postcard. As you said, we have to find a stamp. We have to have it delivered. We have to print it. We have to buy it and send it, and somebody has to receive it. And thinking about 200 billion artifacts in circulation was really mind-blowing for me.
You dig into the meaning of postcards, what it means that we embrace these and sent them. And there's a tip here in your subtitle, our first social network. Can you talk about that idea of sending these cheap postcards, quick, cheap, easy to send, as a sort of social network?
Yeah, one of the things that has been fascinating to dig into with this project is the idea that there's a sender and a recipient. And it's not just sort of performative tourism of, oh, look, here I am, I sent this postcard, and here's my demonstration that I went to this really cool touristy thing. But there's also the sort of material life of the postcard, that it's received. Some people save them, some people don't save them. And there's this sense that the postcards are forming the lines of networking that I think we reenact over a century later with digital social networks like Twitter and Instagram. The idea that there's a post and that people respond to it, or the idea that that there's an image and that it sort of has this sense, like there's a really good sort of Instagram aesthetic. There were really good postcard aesthetics 100 years before. And so I think that there are a lot of the similar ways that social networks function that we think about today. A lot of the precedents for this were set down by this older social network made up of postcards.
One thing that really struck me, I think of postcards mainly as, you know, the thing you send when you travel. They were big in rural America as kind of this lifeline of communication. Can you talk about how it swept rural communities across the U.S.?
Yeah, it's such a fascinating story. So in 1909, the U.S. Post Office was in danger of going bankrupt, that they were something like $17 million in the red, and it was really quite grim. And 2 years later, in 1911, they're actually running a surplus. They're running something like $200,000 of a surplus. And there's this huge question of, well, what happened? What happened in 2 years that could turn around the postal situation like that? And the historian Daniel Gifford had gone through the postal archives to figure out that it's simply the sheer number of postcards that are being bought and sold and sent through the United States Postal Service at that point. And so, excuse me. And so one of the big ways that this really turned was it was establishing connections between rural people in rural America with people in urban America. And so there is this sort of networking effect that's happening.
We're talking to Lydia Pine about her new book out next week, Postcards, The Rise and Fall of the World's First Social Network. Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. David is with us in Madison. David, hi.
Yeah, hello. How are you?
Good. What'd you want to tell us about David?
Just kind of neat. I was going through my dad's stuff, you know, right down to the fishing tackle and the last of the stuff. He passed a while ago. And one of the things that was in there, it was a cardboard, I'd call it a can, and it had like a tin top and a tin bottom to it. And I opened it up, and there was a postcard inside, and it said, "Send your used gold here." And, you know, they would buy it back for 35 cents an ounce or whatever. But there was a penny postcard in there, so that had to be like from the 30s or 40s maybe. I just thought that was kind of cool with the penny postcard, though.
Interesting, David. Thanks a lot for sharing that. Yeah, Lydia, a lot of postcards were sent for personal communication. A lot of them, you write, were for advertising or business schemes like the one David's dad, it sounds like, ran across.
Yeah, if I could just jump in with that. Yeah. I'm so excited that David had that example to share, because certainly postcards were an incredibly cheap form of advertising. And lots of companies did things like that to advertise either personal businesses or to advertise for their company. And it really was fairly ubiquitous. One of my favorite examples that I folded into the introduction of the book was a postcard that was sent out by a church in Kansas that was reprimanding people for not attending services. And so this idea that there's advertising or there's some sort of like, not just, hey, wish you were here. There's certainly that element to postcards as well.
Yeah, our producer Bill Martin's liked a one that you printed saying, hey, we all felt bad you didn't make it to Sunday school last Sunday. Hope to see you next week.
Exactly.
The guilt card. I love it. Thanks, David, for sharing that with us. We'll go next to Madeline in Rice Lake. Madeline, hi.
Hi. So I just wanted to share a little story of my parents and I. Before I got married, my parents and I took a last trip of me being single, and we went across Lake Michigan in the SS Badger ferry. Mm-hmm. And in the gift shop, they had a thin little wooden postcard. And I thought, I want to send this to my fiance. And it was so cute. I wrote a little letter, and it was such a cute little postcard. I told him, hang on to this, because when we're married and we have our little home, like, I would like to have this as decor. And I have it now in a little cabinet tucked away, kind of cute.
I love it, Madeline. Thank you so much for sharing that. A lot of sentimental value, Lydia, not just for Madeline, but for a lot of people on maybe that particular postcard.
No, exactly. That there really is this sort of resonance in it. And it's not just building any kind of network. It's really building this personal network and this personal connection. And it's sort of like this material manifestation of, hey, here's this thing. And I remember doing this thing. So that's a brilliant example.
Thanks for that call. We're talking about the history and the present of postcards with Lydia Pine. She's an affiliate researcher in the Institute for Historical Studies at the University of Texas at Austin and author of the new book, Postcards, The Rise and Fall of the World's First Social Network. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you send and or receive postcards to this day? Do you have fond memories of doing it in the past? Do you have a collection of your own or maybe a family member's in a box? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Lydia Pine about her newest book, Postcards, The Rise and Fall of the World's First Social Network. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Fountain City. John, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, John?
Years ago, a very good friend of mine started a postcard chain letter idea. And he set up groups that you could pick a theme and you would get postcards from all over the world, all over the country, I got a huge stack of them, and it was a great, fun project.
And, John, have you gotten some ones from around the world?
Oh, yeah, from all over Europe, Africa, Soviet Union in those days.
I love it, John. Thanks a lot for sharing that. Lydia, you have been on a postcard sending mission, I understand, as part of your research for the book.
So, as part of the research for the book, but also just out of, I loved sending and receiving postcards as a kid and decided that I wanted to do the same with my nieces and nephews, who are thoroughly in the Gen Z demographic. And it was this utter novelty when I started doing it a couple of years ago when I started this research project. And it's been really fun for the kids to receive and to start sending them. That's been the other fun thing to sort of build the network back the other way is to be able to have them start sending some postcards to me as well.
Thanks a lot for that call. We had an email from Greg who says his father passed away some years ago, was an avid postcard collector. Greg says he's held on to his collection, not knowing what to do with it, apart from a few he wants to personally keep. He wonders, you know, can you get these appraised? Or can you sell these things or at a minimum donate them so that someone can enjoy them as much as his dad did? There is a collector's market, but there's a lot of postcards out there, right, Lydia?
There are a lot of postcards out there. I know that some public libraries are interested in collections and just sort of building their own picture archives. Some historical associations are interested in building those. Some folks opt to sort of disassemble personal collections like that through eBay or Etsy. So I think that those seem to be the most popular, the popular options for what to do with the collection if you don't want to keep the shoebox.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Susie is on the line in New Berlin. Hi, Susie.
Hi. I called in postcards are really important to me. And as an art teacher and an art therapist, I use postcards a lot. But here's one thing. In talking to a friend of mine, we haven't lived near each other since we were 18, but have known each other for 59 years now. And she just told me that she has saved every single postcard and letter I have ever written to her.
Aww.
And so, it's like, and I remember writing a lot of those postcards from, you know, family vacations all the way up until taking our kids on family vacations, you know, and I stopped sending them too much these days, but still send them once in a while. So anyway, she's got my life in a shoebox.
Susie, thank you so much. That reminds me, Lydia, a big point you make is, you know, a postcard on a shelf is one thing, but it really becomes something based on, you know, what we do with it, who we send it to, the message we write, and what they do with it when they get it.
Yeah, one of the things that's been really interesting about this project is the sense that I tell people about it, and the first thing folks say usually is, well, does anybody send postcards anymore? And the answer is emphatically yes, people do send postcards. So for example, in the last couple of elections, postcards to voters have been really popular. There are programs that you can arrange to have postcards sent on your behalf. People still send them sort of almost in defiance of fast communication to say, look, here, we can celebrate the slowness of a postcard. And so it's really neat to see people, I think, embracing the qualities that postcards offer. They don't offer the speed of an Instagram post, but they offer sort of that material connection. The idea that here's this thing and it took this effort and I thought of you.
Thanks so much for sharing that story. We'll go to Amanda next in De Pere. Amanda, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I like to use the cheesy postcards from the 80s. Draw pictures on them and write jokes for my 6-year-old nephew and send them through the mail. And he just loves the surprise when the postman brings it.
Is this something you've been doing over the COVID time?
Definitely during the COVID time. And he's just learning how to read. He's in kindergarten. So it's a great way for him to practice those letters.
I love it, Amanda. Thanks a lot for telling us about that. Lydia, what do you think of the story?
Oh, that's brilliant. I think that there's a huge historical precedent for it. Not only is it just really cool and an amazing thing to be doing, but you're tapping into this sort of 150 years of postcards to do it.
Thanks, Amanda, for sharing that with us. We're talking to Lydia Pine about her new book, Postcards, The Rise and Fall of the World's First Social Network. Back to your calls now. We've got Paul with us in Toma. Paul, hello. Are you there, Paul?
Yeah. Hi.
Hi. What's you had a story for us, I think, Paul. What did you want to tell us about?
Yeah, well, when my son was in Cub Scouts way back in the mid-90s, I started a program, helped him do a program for his national requirement for one of his badges. And what we did is we sent out postcards to all 50 governors and had them sign a card and send it back to us that said, peace through cooperation. It was because back in the day, presidents became presidents either being governors, senators, or congressmen. But as a result, like I said, he got 47 out of 50.
Wow.
And the three, only three of them didn't respond because we were outside of the state. That was back when we were in Louisiana. So,
I got to ask, did you keep those or did he keep those?
We did for a very long time. Then I became homeless for a while and I had them with me and they got lost to the wind. But they were quite the collection. We had Mario Cuomo back in the day, and we had we got a letter from President-elect Clinton, and we got one from the replacement governor of Arkansas, and several of the governors were either died within a year or were convicted.
Thanks a lot. I'm sorry you ran into hard times and had to give those up, but a great story still, Lydia. I love that, writing to public officials and getting responses from most of them.
That's fantastic. I think it really speaks to sort of the ubiquity and the flexibility of postcards as a medium, to be able to have all of these different ways for postcards to be sent and received and to have them intersecting people's lives. I love it.
Thanks for sharing that with us, Paul. We've got Dick on the line in La Crosse now. Dick, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I remember postcards. I was a little farm boy in Iowa back in the 50s. And I would get a postcard from my grandparents who would travel to California, and I would get a picture of the Golden Gate Bridge. Or when they went to Mount Rushmore, it would be Mount Rushmore. And so it was the best pictures I ever saw of those kind of historical figures from throughout the states when they traveled. And so I just thought that was very special to have them think of me. But I also got to see something that they saw that was kind of an icon.
I love it, Dick. Thanks for sharing that. And I'm also glad he called, Lydia, because you reminded me. I wanted to ask you about, you know, how places are represented in these postcards that people like Dick's grandparents were sending.
Oh, that's a fantastic segue. And there are two things that come to mind with that. One, certainly there are these famous places like Mount Rushmore or the Brooklyn Bridge or the Eiffel Tower or things like that that become really codified as tourist stops. Through postcards. It's like, hey, I went to this place and I am going to send you this postcard of this famous thing. But there's also, in the early 20th century, postcards are also serving a role in sort of early photojournalism, where real picture postcards that are basically just pictures that are printed on postcard stock are a alternative or an option for the sort of early days of photojournalism. And so for things like the Mexican Revolution or for political rallies and protests and things like that of the early 20th century, postcards become a way of dissembling and being able to sort of make people aware of places and of things that are happening there.
Just in our last minute, you know, 20 years from now, we're not going to open up that box of Instagram posts. Do you worry that we're losing something if a lot of that kind of a quick communication is in this non-physical form that postcards were?
That's an interesting question. And I would say yes and no. That, yes, yeah, certainly, I hope that nobody's printing out my Instagram posts to save the way, I would hope that people would save a postcard. But I also look at how many postcards have been lost, right? That we don't have those 200 billion postcards still with us. And so I think that there will be some things that sort of filter through and are saved. And that's pretty neat.
Lydia, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us again.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That's Lydia Pine, affiliate researcher in the Institute for Historical Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. We talked to her about her new book. It's called Postcards, The Rise and Fall of the World's First Social Network. Hits the shelves here in the U.S. on December 21st. Love to hear more of your postcard stories. You can share them over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Maybe even you can share a picture of one that you've kept or found in that treasure trove from a relative. Again, you can share that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I think we'll have more stories to share later this week. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the U.S. Surgeon General is raising concerns about the mental and emotional well-being of younger Americans. Two Wisconsin experts join the show for a look at the problem and possible solutions. Plus Food Friday, and it's time to bake some cookies. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, there are continuing concerns about inflation in the U.S. economy and around the world. The Federal Reserve is looking at possible action. We'll get to the basics on what the Fed is and what powers it has when it comes to inflation, what it all means for prices you might pay in the year to come. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.